Pete McMurray in the Skyline Studios. Coming up on today's show, we'll talk to Northwestern Dr. Ben Singer. He'll be live on the show, taking all your questions on Facebook, your text messages, your phone calls. He'll take all your coronavirus calls at 2:07. Illinois Governor J.B. Pritzker joins us at 1:30 today, live before his press conference. And tonight on ESPN, we're all excited here in Chicago for this.
Here comes Chicago. 17 seconds. 17 seconds from game 7 or from championship number 6. Jordan open. Chicago with the lead.
God, I love it. I can't wait. ESPN 10-part series, The Last Dance, debuts tonight. Let's bring in the man who announced the 1998 NBA Finals. It is Bob Costas. Bob, first of all, are you safe and your family safe?
Yes, we all are, thankfully, just waiting it out like everybody else.
Yes, and we need things to watch on TV. And when we heard about this 10-part series, The Last Dance, that they were going to move up to tonight, we're very excited here in Chicago.
I think you should be. It's an epic topic, and everything I can determine, and I'm as anxious to see it as everyone else, to see it in full, but from everything I can determine, this is going to be tremendous. Jason Hare was a young producer who worked with me at HBO, like beginning 20 years ago, and you could tell even then that he was exceptionally talented. Since then, he's done documentaries for ESPN about the 85 Bears, that memorable season.
Oh, yeah.
About Andre the Giant, the wrestler, and you might think that that's just something to laugh at, but it was a touching human story. And I know from my personal experience with Jason that he's not one of these guys who's out just to be provocative or looking for some kind of soundbite or clickbait. He's there to tell a full, textured, nuanced story, and ESPN gave him the time and the resources to tell it. And also, because it's Michael Jordan, there's no need to hype it.
Right.
The story itself, well told, is going to draw people in. And even before COVID-19 changed the way we're living for the time being, they were going to air this in and around the NBA Finals in June. So it would have had a large audience then. Now, I don't know if it'll have as large an audience with the promo power of NBA Finals games, but it's going to have a very, very large audience because, A, people, sports fans, are hungry for new programming.
Right.
But, B, under any circumstances, Michael Jordan and the 90s Chicago Bulls cut through everything. I've always said, does it engage the hardcore fans? They're still talking about it. They're still comparing Michael to LeBron and to everybody else. Yes, but the thing about it was that Michael Jordan was of interest to a little old lady from Omaha who wouldn't know a free throw from a pick and roll. And I said that in 1998 during the finals, which I worked with Isaiah Thomas and Doug Collins.
Right.
If this ends with the Bulls winning, this was before Game 6 in Utah. If this ends with the Bulls winning, and if there's reason to believe that this might be the series that brings the curtain down for Michael Jordan's Chicago Bulls, this is a story that isn't just on the cover of Sports Illustrated. This is a story that Time and Newsweek and the Wall Street Journal will cover. And that turned out to be true because he transcended it all.
Right. Here we are 22 years later and we're still talking about it. I remember that 1998 season. Every bar, everybody would DVR games. Well, they'd recorded on their VHS back in the day, but every game was recorded. Every bar was full, even for a regular season game. But we saw Michael Jordan play. You saw Michael Jordan behind the scenes during timeouts. What's happening as he's talking to his players? Tell us about that, because this 10-part series doesn't really paint a likable picture of Michael Jordan because he was such a competitor.
I'm not so sure it's going to come across as unlikable. I know that Michael himself has expressed that concern, and apparently he was very open with Jason Hare in their lengthy interviews. I don't think it's going to play out that way. I think he will be seen as a textured person, and people will take into account that in addition to his wonderful talent, what made him and his team what they were was his fierce determination, his almost over-the-top competitiveness, and he took some people along with him, even incredibly talented people like Scottie Pippen and lesser players like Scott Burrell. He took them along with him. He drew out of them more than they might have realized they had. And in the end, they were part of one of the great sports stories in American history. So I'm sure whatever little bruised feelings they may have had in the moment, they look back on it now and say that it was all worth it. I don't think that Michael Jordan is going to come out of this with his public image damaged. I think it may be altered, but it'll be altered toward greater understanding. And remember, this comes not long after Michael gave a very touching eulogy for Kobe Bryant, in which we saw a more vulnerable and endearing Michael Jordan than we've ever seen before. So right. I think that people will have, with those two things combined, they're going to have a fuller and clearer view of Michael Jordan. I think it'll be all to the good.
We're talking with Bob Costas. Game 6 of the 1998 NBA Finals, the last 60 seconds. I watched it twice yesterday, knowing that you were going to be on the show today, Bob. And mm-hmm. it's probably one of the most exciting games I have ever seen, one of the most exciting finishes I've ever seen. Can I just run through a few things and you can comment?
Sure.
Jordan ties the game at the free throw line with 59 seconds left. You think, okay, the Jazz going to hold on to the ball. I mean, it just kept going and going. Stockton runs down, hits the three, 41 seconds left. Jordan gets the ball, layup against Russell to cut it to one with 37 seconds left. Then, if that's not enough, the Jazz bring down the ball. Jordan steals it from Malone with 18 seconds left, doesn't call a timeout, takes the ball down, and makes that jumper, the greatest exit in the history of professional sports.
Yeah, it really is. And we sensed it at the time. You know, Ted Williams hit a home run in his last time at bat, but it wasn't in the World Series. Regular season game on a dark and dank afternoon at Fenway Park in front of like 10,000 people and no national television audience. Derek Jeter got a walk-off base hit at Yankee Stadium in his last home game in the bottom of the ninth. There was something very theatrical about that, but nothing to the level of what Jordan did, considering what was at stake and how he completely dominated not just the game. He scored 45 points. And remember, Scottie Pippen was hobbled with a bad back.
Right.
So Jordan, even more so than usual, had to take up the slack. He's 35 years old. That's an advanced athletic age. So he scores 45 points. But in that last minute, if you scripted it that way and handed it to somebody in Hollywood, they'd say, isn't this a little bit over the top?
But
Doug Collins made a great point. You know, Doug is, in my mind, the best NBA analyst ever. With
Agreed.
All due respect to the others, Doug was always so insightful. And he said immediately that the second-to-last basket was crucial. He didn't know what was going to happen after, but he immediately said they let him score so quickly because they didn't want to foul him. They're up by three after Stockton made the three-pointer. They didn't want to foul him. So they kind of laid back, and he just sliced right through them and made the layup right off the inbounds pass following the timeout. And that meant that they didn't go deep into the shot clock, right? So now
right.
the Jazz couldn't sit on the ball. They were going to have to try and score. Now down at the other end, Rodman, who always gave Malone a hard time, Rodman is on Malone. Jordan leaves his man and sneaks up behind Malone on his blind side along the baseline and slaps the ball away and steals it. So he's made the two free throws.
Right.
He's made the layup.
Yep.
He makes the steal, and now he makes the classic jumper. And I'm going to say this. I know that people in Utah and whatever few Jordan haters remain don't want to buy this. They've said for more than two decades that he pushed off. Brian Russell, bless his heart, was faked out. What Michael did was almost like escort him out of the way, like the maitre d' showing you to your table. He didn't push off. He was going to be open anyway. And then he buried the shot.
Oh, I have that shot. I have that picture hanging in my basement. I love it so much. And as you were describing it, it's ingrained in my memory. But you mentioned that Michael scored 45 points in the final game in a Bulls uniform. Remember when he came back, that's the number he wore, number 45. And then he switched to number 23, mm-hmm. the 96 season. But, you talk about divine intervention. But when I see this footage, it makes me happy. I get excited about it. But then I get angry because Jerry Krause was bitter and he broke up this team. They could have came back for another year. Scotty has told me that on the radio. Dennis Rodman has told me that on the radio. I'm sure Michael would have came back in 99. Why did they break it up?
I guess. And the documentary we're about to see is going to perhaps shed some greater light on this. I guess it was Krause's own statement to Phil Jackson. You can go 82-0, and this is still the end of it. Now, was Krause correct in saying that he, and perhaps some others, did not get enough credit for the Bulls' success? Yes. You know, he swung a trade to allow him to select Scottie Pippen. He didn't draft Michael Jordan, Rod Thorne did.
Yep.
But he swung a trade that allowed the Bulls to acquire Scottie Pippen. He made a trade that wasn't popular with some on the roster when he sent Charles Oakley to the Knicks for Bill Cartwright, but that was an important acquisition. And he was always filling in other ways. Tony Kukoc, you know, Pippen and Jordan gave him a hard time in Barcelona during the 92 Olympics, but Tony Kukoc was a very important piece, and Krause in the front office went out and got him. There were always key people around the edges, and Rodman himself. Rodman is added after the first three-peat. Krause did a very good job, and he didn't receive the credit he deserved. But that didn't mean that he had to become unhinged and say, let's break this thing apart
right. So
I can show everybody just how great I am by rebuilding it from scratch.
I just don't understand that. Was he bitter that he had to pay Michael $33 million his final year?
Well, if anybody was bitter, it should have been Jerry Reinsdorf. It was Jerry's money, Jerry Reinsdorf, not Jerry Krause's money.
I don't know. Right.
I'm not a psychologist. I can't answer that.
And correct me if I'm wrong. When Michael left to go play baseball in 94, I want to say we were a game away against the Knicks from going to the finals again with Scotty without Michael.
Yeah, that's right. That's
okay.
Right. You know, the Knicks teams under Pat Riley, they weren't beautiful to watch like his Showtime Lakers.
Right.
But they were tough. They were tough, and they were very, very physical. And they gave first Michael and then Scotty as the leader of the team without Michael, gave them a very tough time.
One of the positives from this coronavirus is we're all stuck in our houses, and I have a 14-year-old, and I'm showing him how much we used to hate the New York Knicks in the 90s because those games were wars. The fact that they were all flagrant fouls towards the end of the game in the playoffs between the Bulls and the Knicks, but they were called as regular fouls in the 90s. They were just wars.
Yeah. The Knicks were very, very physical. You know, the Jordan rules, which dates back to Detroit, and there's certainly no love lost between some of those Pistons and Michael Jordan and the Bulls, but the Jordan rules, Sam Smith's book, that started in Detroit. But Pat Riley and the Knicks didn't just continue it. They may have taken it to another level, partly because the Knicks teams were not as talented as those Pistons teams were.
Right. We're talking with Bob Costas. The Bulls' Last Dance debuts tonight. 10-part series, 2 episodes tonight on ESPN. I want to ask you about Major League Baseball before you go. MLB has been throwing around the idea about playing in Arizona under self-quarantine. Mike Trout, who has a pregnant wife, said, you know, I don't think I'm really comfortable with this. Where do you see MLB going with the season?
Everything is just guesswork, and Rob Manfred with baseball and the commissioners of all the sports have to have contingency plans, best-case scenarios, worst-case scenarios, and everything in between. But when you talk about baseball, to get any kind of representative regular season in, let's say half, 81 games, that requires lengthy quarantine. Plus, if they're going to expand the playoffs, which they probably would do, many of those teams and players would remain in quarantine beyond that abbreviated regular season. And as you alluded to, Pete, these are young ball players with young families. Being away from those families for that long a period of time,
Yeah. Little
children or children on the way, that's going to be difficult for a lot of people. Plus, when you talk about this idea of self-quarantine, best laid plans. But you can see so many things going wrong with that. What about the person, even without fans in the stands, the people who have to pick up the towels in the clubhouse, drive the bus,
Right. Turn
on the lights at the ballpark? What happens, inevitably, when players are injured? Are you going to have guys at the AAA level playing practice games somewhere? Are they all going to be quarantined? Some of them are going to have to be brought up to the regular roster. There's just so many things that could go wrong in these scenarios. And then you have not just a human tragedy, if that's the way it turns out, which is the most important thing, but you got a PR nightmare. Oh, look what happened.
Right.
They came back and played, and look what happened here. So when it comes to baseball, and maybe even football in the fall, I'll believe it when I see it. I think the more practical scenarios, and even these are problematic, you could see hockey or basketball, if they just start with the playoffs, because they have enough regular season games to start the playoffs as soon as they come back, it's possible to imagine, even though it would be problematic, to imagine them quarantining for about a month and getting some version of their playoffs over with. Maybe.
Well, if you're a professional team, don't you want to be the first to come back? I know you have to take precautions, but we're all dying for sports here. I feel like the NBA wants to make something happen to come back and start the playoffs.
I think they're the ones best positioned to do it. And I'm just guessing here, but if they did it, I think what they would do is they'd seed the playoffs based on where the regular season was when they suspended play, but they'd probably cut it in half. So instead of eight teams from each conference, you'd have the top four teams from each conference. That way you could consolidate the playoffs. You isolate everybody in one place. Likely it's Las Vegas. You don't need as many days off because you're not traveling. And you get it all done in a compressed schedule, and somebody emerges as a champion. And people watch those games because they're starved for content.
Right. Bob, you've announced some of the most exciting sporting events in history. Basketball, baseball, the Olympics. What's been your favorite over the years?
Well, baseball and basketball have always been my two favorite sports from the time I was a kid. I think as a moment that I did play-by-play of, it's the Jordan game, Game 6, and that whole season, which turned out to be so memorable. And then in baseball, I think the two most memorable things were where I was the host, not the play-by-play man. 86 World Series, when the ball went through Buckner's legs and it slipped away from the still star-crossed at that point Red Sox. And then 2 years later, when Kirk Gibson hit the pinch-hit home run in Game 1 of the World Series for the Dodgers off Dennis Eckersley of the A's, it wasn't just that that was dramatic. Any World Series homer with two outs in the bottom of the ninth to turn defeat into victory is going to be dramatic.
Right.
But the way that whole thing played out, as you watch it now, not just the way Vin Scully masterfully called it, that's almost a given when you talk about Scully, but the way it was directed by Harry Coyle and produced by Mike Weissman. If this was a movie and they could do it over and over again, I don't think they could have done any better. In real time, they produced something that wasn't just a baseball telecast. It was pretty close to a cinematic masterpiece.
Mm-hmm.
And I've spoken with Kirk Gibson about this. He remembers it largely, not entirely, obviously, he was there, he did it. But in retrospect, he remembers it largely through the prism of how it was presented on television.
Wow. I mean, I have the visual of him, you know, moving his arms, Kirk Gibson, as he rounds first base to hit second. I mean, that's just such an iconic moment in sports history. Bob, you are the best. What are you doing during self-quarantine? Are you like all of us watching Ozark and Tiger King on Netflix? What are you doing?
I've been watching a lot of vintage games on the NBA Network and on the MLB Network. And in some cases, I flick the thing on. And I go, this looks like a game I'd want to watch. And then I go, wait a second, I did that game. Isn't that me? I swear, that's happened a couple of times. I've forgotten which games I've done. You know, and then the curse is you watch it, and it's a good broadcast, but you say to yourself, why didn't I think of this in the fourth inning or in the second quarter? I've talked to Al Michaels about this. No such thing as a perfect broadcast, even if we do what most people think is a really good job.
Of course.
We're beating ourselves up afterwards. So you have to go back and relive that agony.
You're going to find all the mistakes. Another thing that I've been watching is old game shows, Match Game back in the day. They used to film Match Game all in one day, and they do five shows on a Monday, and during the fourth and fifth show, they'd open up the bar behind the stage. So everyone would be drunk, and they would do that on Hollywood Squares. And here's a question for you. How would you rank these TV personalities drinking strictly on their 1970s game show appearances? Because we're all drinking like we're back in college right now.
Yep.
Brett Summers, Charles Nelson Reilly, Richard Dawson, Nipsey Russell, Fannie Flagg. In what order?
I think the first two you mentioned seem to me, now maybe I didn't know them personally, so maybe it's their, but Brett Summers seemed like she was half in the bag on the first taping.
Yeah,
Charles Nelson Reilly had a thing going that I don't know it, that you, where you could really judge it.
Right.
I will tell you this, which is not the question you've asked, but you might be interested. I was on the Hollywood Squares once in 1987. And when they asked, I was surprised, but I thought, you know, as an American, it's your duty. Your nation calls.
Of course.
You have to be on the Hollywood Squares. And they taped all five in one day. They asked you to bring changes of clothes, and it was a very amusing experience.
That's the best. Bob Costas, thank you so much. Are you going to be watching tonight on ESPN?
Yeah.
Okay. I love it.
I sure am. A, what else do I have to do? And even if I had plenty else to do, this is enough to make you stop in your tracks and not miss a minute.
I love it. Bob, you're the best. Happy self-quarantine and happy Greek Easter, too. I forgot to mention that.
That's correct. This weekend's Greek Easter. You are correct, sir.
Love it. Have a great day. Thank you, Bob.
All right, Pete. Thanks so much. Bye.